Thank you very much. Pretty impressed that such a big crowd comes out as when getting close to Pesach. Yes, definitely feel like I just came out of Egypt. But I'll go a bit backwards. How did a girl from Sydney, Australia end up in Kharkov, Ukraine? It was actually the Soviet Union when we went. I, as a teenager, started getting closer to, I'm from a religious home, but started getting closer to Chabad. And what actually inspired me so much in the Chabad movement and what became a dream as every rebellious teenager wants to do something like change the world, I just loved the idea of shlichut, the idea that one day I'm going to go to a place, to some exotic place, and change the world. I don't know if I meant so exotic like Kharkov, but that was the idea. I was in 1988, I finished school in Sydney, and I went to study 2 years in New York, in Brooklyn, by the Lubavitcher Rebbe. I got married to my husband, Moshe Moskowitz, from Caracas, Venezuela, and we started to look into different options of where we could go, our exotic place, where we could go on shlichut, where we could do what we had always dreamed of doing, both my husband also. And in the beginning, we started looking into South America. My husband being from Caracas, I started learning Spanish. I bought myself a book, how to learn Spanish in 20 minutes a day. I had all these stickers all over my kitchen, how to say door, window, table, chair. It helped me to understand my mother-in-law, so I guess it wasn't worth nothing. And we looked into Puerto Rico, we looked into Argentina, we were looking into different places. And then one day my husband comes back from the Koilel, it was a Friday morning, and he says, can you believe it? They're just opening up an opportunity to go on shlichut to the Soviet Union. And I said, oh, that's so amazing, that's so nice. And I see that my husband like has this like sparkle in his eyes, and I was like, you've got to be kidding, not us. And then, and we actually had a child at the time. We had my son Mendel, he was already 6 months old. And it was just the summer of 1990. It was just the beginning of the end of the Soviet Union as we understood it then. And they started to look into options of maybe sending couples for a year to try out. But everybody who had children had gotten a negative answer from the Rebbe. On that Friday morning, there was just one couple who, the Kamenetskys from Dnipropetrovsk, they married already a year, they didn't have kids, and they decided they're going to go there for a year. And I told my husband, listen, you see, they're not sending people with kids. It's not that kind of a place. Let's just stick to the Spanish. That was Friday morning. On Sunday morning, the rabbi in Moscow, Rabbi Lazar, he also wrote to the Rebbe, he also wanted to go on this, to the Soviet Union, and he had a little child, he had a four-month-old daughter, and he got a positive answer from the Rebbe, so my husband was like, aha, you see, it is an option. So we started to look into it to find out what it was, what was it about there. What did excite us about is definitely exotic. Also the opportunity of a whole new frontier. This is going to be a whole new country that, I mean, I'm sure many of you remember that we didn't even know what the Soviet Union even looked like. It was way before internet. Even on the television, you never ever saw anything. I mean, the closest I had ever seen the Soviet Union was when they had the Moscow Olympics. I think for 3 minutes we got to see like a little bit of what was happening over there, but no one even knew what at all it was like. But we looked into it and it sounded interesting. We spoke to our family. My parents thought, okay, listen, 1 year, well, then you go somewhere normal afterwards. My in-laws, it was a little bit harder. My father-in-law was born in Ukraine. He was in Auschwitz. He was a Holocaust survivor. And in his mind, the Ukrainians and the Nazis were exactly the same. So he, in the beginning, they was like, you've got to be kidding. You can't go back there. For him, it was like going back to Nazi Germany. And a few days later, they called us up and said, we don't want to hold you back. If you really want, you can, you can ask and see what happens. So we wrote to the Rebbe and we wrote that we know that medically speaking and education-wise for our children, it won't be easy there, but we're sure with the Rebbe's blessings that everyone will be fine. And within 5 minutes, we got an answer from the Rebbe that it should be b'shah tova u'mutzlachat, that it should be in a good and successful. So we were chosen to go to Kharkov, Ukraine. It was Soviet Union then, because Kharkov was just being returned, the synagogue that was for 70 years. It was 1913. It was built in 1921. It was taken away from the Jewish community and used as a sports complex. So basically it was football, boxing, basketball. It was like this gigantic, beautiful synagogue in the middle of the center on Pushkinskaya 12 was being used all these years for a, was being used all these years just for a play sport. And they were just going to be giving it back. It was the first building that in the times of Gorbachev, the first synagogue that was going to be returned to the Jewish community. And they said, this is, we definitely need to have a rabbi. We need to have a couple who'll be able to, you know, help the Jewish community. So they asked us, you know, Kharkov, is that okay for you? I said, you know, something, I have no idea where Kharkov is, so I guess so. And whatever, I changed the book. I bought Russian in 20 minutes a day. But that was a little bit harder. I tell you the truth, Spanish was a little bit easier. I had the Russian, I had the thing, my husband and me, then we also bought a tape. I remember the first word was, excuse me, which is Isvinitsia. And me and my husband were like 5 minutes trying Isvinitsia, forget it, we'll learn it there. We took these three rabbis together. We were the rabbi that was going to the Dnieper, Moscow, and us. We took a crash course in Russian. We learned how to say, count from 1 to 100, how to say what my favorite season of the year is. We also learned how to say, what time is it? But we wouldn't have understood the answer, but we knew how to ask the question. And we started buying everything we had. We were told that we were allowed to bring 10 boxes of anything that we could think of. So we bought all America's different appliances. We bought from 120 to 220. We bought lots and lots of coats for what we assumed was going to be Siberian winters. Diapers for the baby, anything, you know, clothes. And actually, one lady had donated us a box of, she made cholent, you know what cholent is, chamin, right? So she basically made a gigantic cholent, and she got it put into cans. So we had a whole case of canned cholent to start us off. And we were on our trip. We were ready to go. We were all excited. We are, you know, we're going to change the world, right? So we're going to Moscow. I'm at the time 20, my husband's 25 with our 8-month-old son. And we're flying to Moscow. When we landed there, we land in the airport, we come to customs. And I still, from all the stories that I've heard of Hasidim and, you know, who were, you know, ended up in Siberia, came to, the KGB came and got them, or they took away their tefillin. I was very, very, very nervous. So my husband decided that, you know, Sami, you're, you know, a lady with a little kid, you go first, maybe, like, and you speak more Russian than me. Like, I speak 5 words, you speak 6, you know. So I went with my little dictionary, and the guy asked me something. I said, da, da, da. He said, harasho, harasho. And he let me through. And so then I tell my husband, follow me. So my husband comes with the 10 suitcases. The guy looks at, like, what? Like, no way. And that he had already given us the okay. We quickly ran out. And we got there in the day. I remember it was raining. And it was all gray. And we came to Marina Russia. That was the synagogue in Moscow at the time. Now it's a gigantic 7-story building. Then it was a little small wooden hut. And we came in. I imagine that everyone's going to give us a real Kabbalat Panim. Wow, this couple, Mesirut Nefesh, is coming to the Soviet Union. Amazing. As soon as we walk in, everybody looks at us and they put their faces down. No one says hello. And I said to my husband, like, how are we going to deal with it? It looked like we had just come to a levaya, that everybody was like in mourning and no one is saying hello to us. My son, little cute kid, is running around trying to play with everybody and nobody is smiling and no one is looking at us. Until my husband realizes this is still Soviet Union mentality. They're probably scared of foreigners, scared who we are, know that they shouldn't be speaking to foreigners that are walking in. And in the evening, they put us on a train to Kharkov. We didn't know how we're going to know that we get to Kharkov. We don't know how many hours it's going to be. All we know that is that Kharkov starts with the letter X. X is a Kh in Russian. So basically, we were scared if we missed the stop, we're going to end up literally in Siberia. So basically, we had our 10 boxes and our trusty cholent in one one room. And me, my husband, and our baby in the middle room. We don't know how to switch off the light. We have no idea how to switch off this blasting radio. And every hour, some lady comes and screams at us. And I mean, she was just screaming chai, which just happens to just mean tea. But we had no idea what she's screaming. So she's screaming chai, and we're just going, niet, 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 chai, niet, niet, niet. Don't know how to switch off the radio. And every time the train stops, we're looking outside the window. Is it No, M. Okay, not Kharkov yet. The truth is, it was a Moscow-Kharkov train. Someone could have told us that, but whatever. But so it was a 12-hour train. We get to Kharkov in the morning, and Hashem made it nice that Kharkov, the sun was shining. A guy comes over to me and tells me that, you know, I'm going to be your friend. Everything's going to be okay. You're going to be in a hotel for a little, little. So the hotel for a little, little was 6 months because he had a friend who we didn't realize at the time. He said there's no apartments in the whole Kharkov. He had a friend that he wanted us to rent who was going to make Aliyah in another 6 months. So we were in this hotel, which was not exactly a five-star hotel. It was a dollar a night hotel. And the first night we get there, we got to Kharkov. It was a Thursday. We got to Kharkov Wednesday night. Thursday morning, it was like 5 o'clock in the morning. Our hotel was on the main square in Kharkov. I think Zmirov, she was in right nearby. She remembers it's a very, very big square. At the time, used to have Lenin. He's already been taken down since then. And our window of our hotel was just, it had a nice view of this big square. And at 5 in the morning, I hear a gigantic noise from the square. Anyway, we're a bit jet-lagged. And I look outside, and the entire square is full of tanks and soldiers facing our window. I wake up my husband. I say, Moshe, they came to get us. So my husband looks outside and says, oh my gosh, this is like crazy. I can't believe it. How did they find out so fast that we're here? Then we realize it was August. It was just a military exercise that they just decided to do over there, not connected to us at all. Friday night, we had our first Kabbalat Panim. In the shul. You just have to understand, the shul had just been returned to the community. So 1,000 people had come to see this new rabbi and his wife, but they didn't let us in. They were like pushing. And then we realized, they don't realize that we're the ones they're coming to see. They imagine, what's a rabbi? Some guy with an old white beard and a little stick over this or whatever. People came over to my husband when they finally understood that he's the rabbi and asked, is your wife also Jewish? So at first he thought they were joking, and then he realized so many years of assimilation and so many years of like lack of any Jewish knowledge and background, we were starting from zero when we basically got there. That Friday night, my husband straight away said that Sunday we're going to start a Sunday school for kids, Monday we're going to start a yeshiva. I came on Sunday, I got a few markers and a few, you know, papers, and I had like a trusty translator. I thought, well, how many kids? 10, 15? 150 kids came on Sunday to the school. I was like, And then straight away on that Monday, my husband started a yeshiva. It was 20 guys who learned every day from 9 to 4. We had a translator. Her name was Betsy. I remember her. She was like saying, how long did it take for the Lubavitcher Rebbe to convince you to come here? And it was like, you know, it doesn't exactly work like that. We were actually begging to be able to have the schus to be able to be here. And she would translate for us. Many years later, we would watch the videos and we would see how well she translated. I remember there was one Chanukah. My husband was saying that it's very important on Chanukah. We learned that every day we add one more light. We don't like, we don't go 8, 7, 6, we do 1, 2, 3, which teaches us that every person has to add more and more in life. And she translates it, thank you everybody for coming this evening. But somehow or other, without the translation, we finally got the Russian. You know, what were we eating there in the beginning? So in the beginning they had cans of Pepsi. They weren't cans, they were like Pepsi, and that was our breakfast. For lunch, we used to have like a white bread called lavash. We would turn on the fires over there. And dinner, we had cholent, right? We had our trusty cholent. We had a little burner. We sort of made a little curded in our room, so we'd sort of feel like we have like a house. And we had this little burner. It would be cholent. After a little bit of a few weeks of this a very exciting diet, we decided we should try and a little bit of a change. We had a man, Misha, who spoke a bit of Yiddish, and he would buy our food and he would buy our clothes, the things that we needed. And so I told Misha, you know, if he could also get us some fresh fish. So he says, sure. So he brings everything except for the fish. I said, you know, Misha, you know, I see the watermelon, I see the fruits, I see whatever, but the fish, he says, oh, sure, check in the bath. So I go to the bathroom and there's a live fish in my bath, swimming, this big. I was like, forget about having a bath for the next few weeks. I call my husband on the good trusty, this was before cell phones, you know, I call my husband on the, I said, Moshe, there's a fish swimming in our bath. I need someone to come urgent. So he sent me some old babushka from the shul, the cook from the shul. She came over, she turned the fish into something or other, but we went back to the cholent after that experience. And we had fun with our Russian also. We had, there was once I was in the hotel. As I said, it was a not exactly a 5-star hotel, and a mouse goes by. I don't like mice in any shape and size, but in a hotel room with my 8-month-old son, it was definitely not a happy experience. So I grabbed my son, jumped on the table, took the phone, and I called my husband. Okay, Moisha, there's a mouse here. Forget it. I'm not getting off the table until someone comes to get rid of the mouse. He says, you know something, I don't even know how to say mouse in Russian. You tell them. So he passes the phone to our good old Misha, and I tell Misha that there's a mouse. I'm on the table. Someone has to come and get rid of the mouse. But the problem is that in Russian, the word mouse, Mishka, is very similar to the word bear. Mishka, Mishka. So I'm telling him, like, Mishka and Mishka. To me, it still today sounds the same. So I'm telling him, I think I'm telling him that there's a mouse in the room, and I'm actually telling him there's a bear in the room. And he's laughing his head off and asking me if it's Bolshoi, is it very big? And I was like, oh, Ochun Bolshoi, it's really big. I mean, for me, that was already big enough. He came to the room, he told me that he got rid of it. I'm not exactly sure. I wanted to believe him, but we somehow managed. And as we started, our first Rosh Hashanah, so we got there in Elul of Toshin Nun, which is August 1990. The first Rosh Hashanah is going to be the first time that this shul is going to have a Rosh Hashanah. And most of the people there, they knew something about Pesach matzahs. They had actually seen Pesach, even though they didn't know exactly what they were doing. But somehow, rather, throughout all the years, matzahs people knew about. Rosh Hashanah Ab was something that people, and Yom Kippur was totally non-existent. People had no idea what it was. And 3,000 people came to the Rosh Hashanah, I remember. And my husband comes out with a shofar. Now, for them, Rosh Hashanah, New Year's in the Soviet Union and the whole concept of the New Year's is a very, very heavy party. So everyone's waiting for the New Year's celebration. And then my husband comes out and starts blowing a ram's horn. So that was a little bit, yes, the little bit of a shock to the people. And I was like, where's the party? Like, they said, this is how we start Rosh Hashanah. Someone came just a few days after Rosh Hashanah and comes to my husband, a man. He was already in like his late 80s, speaks fluent Yiddish, and he came with his son, who was around also 50, 60 years old, comes to my husband's office, and he asked my husband, he speaks to my husband in Yiddish, he tells him how he used to be in the cheder, and he asked my husband, when is Yom Kippur? When will it be Yom Kippur? And his son, who's already in his 50s, asks his father, what's Yom Kippur? So my husband said, you know, I usually don't ask questions like that, but how is it possible? You speak fluent Yiddish, you in the cheder. How could it be that your own son doesn't know what Yom Kippur is? And he said, I was scared that my son would tell on me to the authorities. So he would be keeping it all throughout the years, but keeping it in such a way that he should never let his kids know about what he was doing. So we realized that we had a lot of work ahead of us. We opened a kindergarten. Then it was actually the 23rd of February in 1992, which is actually 30 years ago, that we opened our Jewish day school. We started with 40 kids. We had just before the war. It was just on the 23rd of February, just the day before the war, we celebrated with 400 children, our 30 years of our school. And I remember at the time, there was already a lot of a lot of pressure in the air, but I remember my husband was saying to the kids over there, the kids were all there with flowers and with their balloons everywhere. We said the number 30 everywhere, and we remember telling the kids that, you know, the whole world is looking at Ukraine now, what's going to be? And here you kids are amazing that you started your day with a tefillah. You kids are proud Jewish kids. And, it was at the time we didn't realize it was the last day of school, but we just told them that we hope that will just show the whole world the power of the Jewish education and, you know, belief in positivity. As the years went on, we especially, most places in the world, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur is like what everybody knows. In Kharkov, it's Purim, actually. We rent the circus. There's 2,000 places in the circus. Everybody who comes in gets a Mishloach Manot. We read the Megillat Esther in the circus, and all the whole circus, all the circus program, I basically go there before I see what we can use, what we can get the monkeys to do something to Jewish music, get the acrobats to, you know, dance the Hava Nagila, whatever it is, we make our whole Purim program. And there was once Purim, one year was on Friday, and Sunday morning after Purim, an old man comes to my husband, to his office, late 70s, and he tells my husband he wants to do a Brit Milah. My husband was like, wow, like, why all of a sudden now? He said, I'll tell you the truth, is I go every year to Purim. I don't come to shul. I just like to go to Purim to the circus. This year I wasn't feeling so good on Friday. My wife went to the circus and she brought me back the Mishloach Manot. By the time she came home, she ate everything inside. All that was left was just this brochure. And there was a brochure about all the things that your community does. You have a kindergarten, you have school, you have educational classes, you have a camp. You know, I'm a little bit old for that. But then I saw circumcision. I said, oh, I can do that. So he came over to my husband. And he said, and it happened to be that that day, we don't have a moyel all the time, but it happened to be that we had a moyel was there in Kharkov that day, and 2 hours later, he had a bris, and he had a Jewish name, called himself Yaakov. There was another time on Purim, there was another man, his name Slavik. Unfortunately, his wife not Jewish, and he used to go very much to the, he used to go to the church. And he had a good friend whose name is Mark, whatever, Mendel, who always told my husband, was always telling him, you've got to come to the shul. It's just, there's nothing scary about it. You've just got to come, And he would always like nudge him that he has to make it at least one time walk into the shul. And, you know, Mendel made up with him. Okay, you know something, I'm not going to bother you anymore. One time visit the rabbi and then I'm going to leave you alone. So the Slavic said, okay, it's a deal. One time I see your rabbi, half an hour I'm going to speak to him and that's it. So it was a Thursday, Purim that year was on a Sunday. It was Thursday. My husband says, I have a half an hour meeting after my shir, whatever, some guy I have to meet, whatever. The half an hour ended up being 3 hours. And this Slavic said relationship with my husband. At the end, he says he wants to do a bris. And my husband's like, well, you know, there's 630 mitzvahs. You don't have to choose the hardest first. So he says, no, I actually want to be a real Jew. And I realized that's what I need to do. So my husband calls up the moyel, and the moyel says on Tuesday, he can come on Tuesday. And my husband tells her, you know, if you're going to be anyway, Sunday, come and join us for Purim. So this is a guy who, unfortunately, has always been in the church. I mean, I'm pretty sure that most of us don't know exactly what it's like over there. But you can imagine the difference between what he's seen in the church and walking into the Megillah reading on Purim in the time when they say Haman. Okay? I remember his face. He walks into the shul, and exactly at the time they say Haman, everyone is dressed up like clowns in costumes. Everyone's screaming, hey! He says, oh my God, this place is really cool. He went down to the Suda's Purim downstairs. We were having a big Suda, and everybody downstairs tells him, he stands up and he tells everybody, on Tuesday, I'm becoming a real Jew. And Mendel, his friend, tells my husband, you should just know this might not actually happen because his wife is freaking out that he's going to be doing this bris, and the church is even more freaking out because they feel like they're going to lose a good customer and they don't want him to, you know, to have any connection to the shul. So they're putting on a lot of pressure on him. Tuesday morning, my husband comes, the moyel is there, ready to do the bris on Slavik. And he says, you wouldn't believe who came to me last night. This chief priest of the church came over to my house last night, started telling us that, you know, we're a cursed nation, the Jewish people, and you're going to end up in hell, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and a lot of wonderful, nice things about why he shouldn't be doing what he wants to do. And so my husband said, oh, so what did you tell him? So he says, I told him, actually, I was 3 hours with the rabbi, did not hear one thing wrong about anybody else. And he's a big guy, this Slavic. He said, I picked him up, and I threw him out of the house and said, I don't want to see you again. And as he's doing the bris, his phone is ringing the whole time. Finishes the bris, they gave him a Jewish name, Shimon. And then he sees who's the bris called. The bris called is this priest. My husband asks, he tells my husband, oh, what should I tell him? He says, tell him it's too late. It's already done, it's a done deal. And 2 weeks after that, this Slavic, Shimon, already, he was with the mayor of Kharkov. The mayor of Kharkov was Jewish. His name was Gennady Kernes. And he actually had also done a bris. He called himself Moshe. He wanted to have the same name as my husband. He called himself Moshe. And it happened to be that the mayor of Kharkov was together with this Shimon, this Slavic, at a very important event in Kharkov. And a big priest was coming from Moscow to this event. And as he's about to walk in, this priest is walking in, the mayor from Kharkov, also Jewish, this guy Moshe, he tells Slavic, I have a big problem. This guy's going to want to shake my hand, but I'm circumcised. So he sort of decided that a circumcised Jew can't shake hands. So I'm circumcised. So when he comes over here, do you mind shaking his hand instead of me? He says, you wouldn't believe it. I just got circumcised 2 weeks before. So the priest walks in and they both go like this. So 2000, I don't know how much you're following the news in Ukraine, but in 2014, I started a very, very, started a very difficult situation in Lugansk, Donetsk, and Kharkov. These are three cities that the Russians wanted to take over. We are only literally half an hour from the border, half an hour drive from the border with Russia. And they were trying to take over these three cities. We had the whole time, we had shootings, the whole time we had very, very, very difficult situation in Kharkov. And our mayor, this mayor of Kharkov, Moshe Gennady Kernes, he was also originally with the original government, and then he was going back to be with Ukraine, and he was a very, very public figure in the whole story. And one day, as he was going, he used to be very into sport, he was going for a jog, he was shot in the back, an assassination attempt. We quickly arranged him a plane. He straight away lost consciousness. He wasn't sent in a plane. We got a plane to take him to Israel, and he was 4 months in a coma in Haifa. It was interesting, when he woke up, there happened to be a Chabad rabbi next to his bed saying Tehillim with a long white beard. So when he woke up, he thought that he was already. And he starts screaming, "My name is Moshe, I'm Jewish, my name is Moshe, I'm Jewish," just to make sure he shouldn't get up in the wrong place. He actually came back. He was paralyzed the rest of his life, but he actually won. In his wheelchair, he won the elections another two times in Kharkov. And the last time, he unfortunately died last year of corona. He actually was in Germany in a hospital in a coma with corona. He won the elections even like that. So he was somebody extremely popular who built up the city. All throughout these years, we're working on, you know, bringing more and more and more Jews back. Just in the end of January, a month before the war, my daughter Brocha had a wedding in Kharkov. Already then, the news was already talking about the war is going to be in January, the war is going to be in the end of January, the war's not if there's going to be a war. The question was, when is the war going to be? And our plans for my daughter wants her wedding there. We are still going on. The 2 days before the wedding, the Simcha Friedman, the singer at the wedding, says, like, you know, my wife is really scared. Like, can you think of another option? It's like, the wedding is on. We're not changing plans. Everything is on as it's going to be. We're going for it. We had 500 guests. How do you make a wedding for 500 guests in Kharkov, Ukraine? So basically, I took a sports stadium. And we just divided the whole place. I'll send some pictures afterwards for the group. I can show you. I can send you afterwards how we managed to turn the sports stadium into. Basically, we covered all the bleachers with the all the seats with like black curtains. We had like lighting. We had music. It was absolutely amazing. It was like the singer. We had to sort of tell him it's 2 a.m. Says we're already tired. Could you already finish? He was like on such a high. There's all the shlichim from all of the other cities had come. My husband at the chuppah also mentioned that, you know, Hashem should give us a blessing that we should all be able to stay in peace in our cities. The Sheva Brachot finishes. The press starts saying, why are you staying? And why aren't you leaving? And we're like, everything is all in the news. This is all hype. We're just watching it on the news. But in the streets in Ukraine, not just in Kharkov, in the whole Ukraine, you did not feel any pressure of war. It wasn't like, you know, when you have... here in Israel, you know, some kind of a pressure. So everyone starts going shopping. Let's buy toilet paper. Let's quickly fill up our houses with water. Nothing, absolutely nothing on the street. You're only watching on the news. If you wouldn't watch your news, there was no feeling at all that such a thing could actually be happening. When it did start getting a little bit more pressure was a few days before when they started to say that all the Israeli citizens have to leave. But we're still there. The Monday before the war, Monday evening, Russia starts speaking, and we understand that, you know, the Olympics that they were all waiting for actually finished, and it looks like there is more talk of that happening. My husband speaks to all the other 10 families in our city. If anybody wants to leave, you should feel that everyone's with them. We're staying, but if anybody wants to go, no one's leaving. We're all staying. Wednesday, we have our school celebration. On Wednesday night, this is probably for the first time ever, I don't sleep without my cell phone in the room. because whatever, at least we need to have some quiet. So I don't have any phones in my room, but we decided that Wednesday night, you know, just in case, you know, let's take the phones to the room. 5 a.m., someone starts calling, a man's calls at 5 a.m. I said, "Are you okay? Why are you calling at 5 in the morning?" He says, "Don't you know Kharkov is being bombed?" And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" He says, "Oh, you can't hear?" And I go to the window and I hear in the background, bombing. I can't believe this is happening. And the guy tells me, I said, "Where are you? How do you know?" He says, "I'm in the airport. I was about to fly from Borispol in Kiev. I was about to fly to Israel to get out of here. And all the entire airports in Kharkov, in the whole Ukraine, have just now been closed. The war is on." 5 minutes later, I get a phone call. This is 5:05 a.m. I'm trying to get, you know, like everyone's been telling you it's going to happen, and now it's happening. So 5:05 a.m., I get a phone call from one of the mothers in the school. "Hello, Miriam. Is there going to be school today?" I was like, I said, "Are you planning to send your daughter to school now at 5 a.m.? I don't know. I have no idea about anything yet. Just call me back a bit later." 5:10, another 10 minutes after I've got this phone call, my son calls me up. Now we have 10 families in Kharkov on Shlichut as well, together with us. And my son, that 8-month-old Mendel, he came back already also to be a shliach by us. And he has four of my grandchildren. He has, and they live on the 5th floor. My daughter-in-law, who is a little bit more aware of because she's from Kiryat Malachi and she knows more about, a little bit more used to Tilim and missiles and things like that. So she had asked me that if the war starts, could they move into our house because we have a basement? And could I please bring sandbags just in case, we'll put them by the window. So my son Mendel the day before says, "Mommy, just do me a favor. We're staying here in Kharkov with you guys, but can you just bring some sandbags to the house? Take a photo for my wife so she knows that you have them. And we're all good." So the day before, he's like, "Mommy, did you bring the sandbags, please? My wife is really nervous." So I bring 8 sandbags from the shul. We were actually doing renovations. We finished the beautiful renovations on our ladies' mikveh. And to not make the men feel bad, we started on the men's mikveh. So we had these sandbags. I bought like 8 bags, took a photo for my son. Mendel, all good. So then at 5:10, my son calls, "Okay, Mommy, we're coming over with the kids." So my husband, I was like, "I don't know." My husband was like, "You're going to drive now? There's bombs. I don't know. Can you drive? I guess whatever. We have to bring the kids." So I actually had my husband quickly goes to my son. They quickly come down with the 4 kids, half asleep, with two little small suitcases, carry-ons, with all whatever their stuff. They absolutely have no idea how long they're going to be by us. And my grandchildren walk in, and I bring a whole big bag. I had Purim costumes. It was Adar, you know what I'm saying? It's going to be Purim soon. And I let my kids always have Purim costumes on the whole month of Adar so that they can feel that they're in the spirit. So my grandchildren walk in at 5:15 a.m. with like dizzy like faces. It's like, "Safta, we're coming to play by you." And I said, "Yes, everybody downstairs, take the Purim costumes. Everyone can go get dressed." 6 o'clock, I get a phone call from the school. No school. All schools or kindergartens, everything is cancelled. And people can only go outside till 8 in the evening. They're going to start a curfew. So what we did was, me and my husband then took my older daughter, Shayna, she's 16, and my son, also my son, 13. We took them and we drove to shul. When we got to shul, basically none of the secretaries were able to be there because they live far. It's like we're at war. We're hearing bombing in the like distance. We understand that's at the entrance to Kharkov. To get from the border to us is literally 40 minutes. So basically, there was tanks around Kharkov, and they're trying to get in. So we're hearing the bombs in the background, and we understand that we now have a major humanitarian crisis. We basically have a community of 25,000 Jews. And of which there are a lot of people who are now trapped in their homes with no food. People that we daily, they come to shul to eat. People that we take food to, we needed to arrange that. My daughter manned the telephones and people started calling nonstop. And we tried to, we had a few drivers, very, very brave, who started taking the food from the shul and taking it up in different people's houses. This was Thursday. Friday, my husband drives to shul in the morning. I'm going to have to work out how to make, what kind of a Shabbos we're going to have. It was actually Shabbat Mevarchim Adar. So we decided that we're going to make Shabbat in Shul. We're going to have a big Kiddush downstairs. And already on Thursday, people started to stream into Shul. They wanted to move into the Shul to live. As we are speaking now, we have 100 people still living in the Shul basement. That day, people started streaming into the Shul to sleep, to move in, because we had a basement. And we we were also trying to save people. We had people in the subway station, the subway network in Kharkov. It's a city of 2 million people. So basically, that is like the main bomb shelter in Kharkov. There's 15,000 people living there since the beginning of the war, and other people that just come during just for nights and then go home. There was an Israeli family that were stuck for 5 days in the subway. Finally, we got them out. They also moved into the shul together with their dogs and their cats. The shul became a little bit like Noach's teva, a little bit. a little bit hard to convince people like to leave their animals. You say, like, maybe just leave your animal at home. It's like, you've got to be, would you leave your child by the neighbor? And I was like, okay, bring your dog. Just come and we'll save you. So this was Thursday. Friday morning, my husband comes to shul and there's tanks in front of the shul building. And so my husband's driving. He's like, he doesn't know like, which tanks are they. Finally, when he gets there, they asked him to pull down his window, and he sees it's Ukraine. Okay, we're okay. They go into the shul, and they were actually in front of the shul for a day and eating. Also, they came to the shul to eat by us. Friday night, my daughter-in-law and the grandchildren and the little kids are staying home, and I go at 6 o'clock with my husband and my older kids to shul. It's pitch black outside. I don't know if this, they don't do this, I think, in Israel, but basically in Ukraine now during the war, basically there's no lights at night. Basically everybody has to switch off their lights in their house. I guess it's just that people shouldn't be able to, they shouldn't be able to see over there. I'm not exactly sure why. So it's totally pitch dark. Walking to shul, and my daughter's 16, she tells me, Mommy, this looks like the Second World War, like pitch black. And I was like, no, don't compare, it's okay. We get to shul and there's 100 people in shul coming to Davin. So there's also the people that are living downstairs and another people, like all the shluchim, all the rabbis, everybody came, and people who just turned up in shul. There was an old man, 90 years old. My husband said, what are you doing here? And my husband, and he tells my husband, where else should I be in a time of war if not here in shul davening? We get to the shul, and also the shul is full. Everybody, very, very emotional davening. Go downstairs, also make a kiddush with the people who are staying. We go home. It was 11 o'clock at night. It was a very surreal kind of feeling the whole time you're here. I actually had my neighbor, an old man, he's around 80. He was in shul, so we told him, you know, at least come to our house. You can eat by us before, you know, everyone has to go home. Around 11, we hear this gigantic sound of a plane just over our house. So we scream, everybody downstairs for us. We get downstairs. And then my daughter says, What happened? I said, oh, it was probably a Ukrainian plane. He says, so why were you screaming so much? So I was like, okay, no, usually I was like, that was a little bit of a shock. And then I have, my phone is ringing the whole time. We actually decided all the rabbis' houses, all the 10 families, that everybody would have a non-Jewish person sleeping in their house in case something happened, so we should be able to be in touch with each other to make sure everybody's fine. And after that plane goes over, my phone is ringing. So I tell my lady, go, pick up the phone, see what's happening. It was actually my neighbor from across the street. I don't know how she found my number. And she says, can you please tell the mosque just to switch off their lights? Everyone in the street, it's Shabbos by us. So we have all our lights on. We're having like everybody's lights have to get off. So she quickly switches off the light and we all go downstairs. So basically we were on the first floor, and downstairs we sort of made ourselves a three-room little apartment with all our sandbags on the window. It wasn't 8 sandbags in the end. That wasn't enough. We had to bring another 50 sandbags to close all the windows. And Shabbos morning, we go to shul. I also took my little daughter this time. She had been already 3 days in the house. I took her with me. My grandchildren in the house, my little daughter, we all go to shul. And I remember in shul, we were able to start hearing the sounds of the bombing are getting stronger and stronger and stronger. It was already, they said on Shabbat, when you pray for the new month, you say, Misha san nisim lavoteinu, who did miracles for our father. And we were all like thinking, yes, we really need miracles over here. When it came to the Musaf, so my son, who's 14, he was the Chazan, and he came to the part of Hu Elokeinu, Hu Avinu. And there's a song saying, Hu Elokeinu, Hu Avinu. And in the background, you're hearing the bombing. And I keep thinking to my husband, I think maybe we should have to go downstairs soon. We have to go downstairs. But everybody's like mesmerized hearing the bombing, and my son is singing. And my little girl after, my little daughter, my 7-year-old Marcus, she tells me, oh, mommy, now I have a new way to sing the song. It's going to be Hu Elokeinu boom, Hu Avinu boom, boom. We go downstairs for a big kiddush. It's Shabbos Mevarchim. There was no need for any speeches. It was just a lot of singing. In the background, you're hearing bombing. And I asked somebody there whose father was on the on the front. He was there. I said, what is happening? What are we hearing? How many? It's like 3 days of bombing. Like, what's happening? And she says that what's happening here is the Ukrainians don't want to let them in. The tanks are coming here, but so I said, well, how come it's taking them so long? So he said, these are Russian 18-year-old kids, tired. They have no idea why they're even coming to Ukraine. And our soldiers are much more experienced. They're on their turf, and and we're not giving up Kharkov so easily. Sunday morning at 5 o'clock in the morning, I get a message that the Russian forces have entered Kharkov. No one is allowed to leave their homes at all. It's not even curfew. No one is allowed to leave their homes. They're in the city. And now we're sitting, now we're really hearing, we're hearing shooting, we're hearing shootings. And then at 7 in the morning, I get a call from somebody that there's a Russian tank on fire right next to the shul. Basically, a Russian tank had started driving up towards our shul on Pushkin side, which is the main street, and a Ukrainian tank blew it up. And the whole day, the Russian tanks are fighting with the forces until 5 o'clock in the afternoon on Sunday. They got all the Russian tanks or destroyed or out of the city. We breathed a sigh of relief, and we thought, okay, Kharkov is ours. Everything's going to be quiet. I'm not sure if it was revenge or if they were angry or they were surprised, but on Monday morning, started aerial bombing in Kharkov. They started bombing buildings. They started bombing left and right and center. We decided, my husband and us, we're going to go to the shul because we have, for one day, we weren't able to go there, to continue manning the phones and helping all the people that are streaming into the shul and making sure that we can help as many people as possible. The curfew was changed to 6 o'clock earlier. We have to get home at 6. Tuesday morning, 8 o'clock in the morning, they bomb the main government building in the square. The day before, we were on my street, two doors from my house, is the place where you sign up for the army. And my husband's looking out the window and he sees a guy, a man from Al Koilil. He's about 30, 35. His name is Chaim. I said, Chaim, what are you doing here now? You know, there's a war going. He says, yeah, I want to volunteer. I'm going to sign up. He says, oh my gosh, Chaim, so come to our house first. We gave him a pair of tefillin. Someone had also given him a dollar that they had gotten from the Rebbe, and we told Chaim he should be safe. It was very, 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 very emotional that he was going. And that Monday, a Tuesday morning at 8 in the morning, Chaim was supposed to be guarding the house, that big building on the square. But he decided to first to take with his tefillin to daven in shul at 8 in the morning, and he missed and kind of saved his life. 8 o'clock, we hear this gigantic boom. And 5 minutes later, we hear an even louder sound. Everyone starts sending calls. So when you're in the situation, you don't know where it's happening. And I start getting people, my kids telling me, Mommy, do you see where it is? And my kids start sending me these pictures over here of this is the big square is now up in flames. And then all of a sudden, I start getting phone calls from everybody, am I alive? And I was like, well, I guess so. Why? Whatever. He says, don't you know your street was just bombed? Basically, this house, two doors from our house, where was this army base, this house, this building was bombed. So I open the window and the entire street is full of smoke. I went outside, I see the fire department, and it's getting basically much more serious and much more close, and we're starting to realize this is not just, this is hitting civilians. There were civilian buildings going down, hospitals, and then that evening, we still went back to shul that day on Tuesday. Tuesday evening, a very big explosion was next to our school, the same school that we had just celebrated 30 years, our kindergarten and our school, and this explosion nearby ended up blowing out all the windows and all the doors of our kindergarten and our school. And we realized that we have to send our grandchildren. In the end, we also ended up having to join them because our kids did not want to go without us. And on Wednesday morning, we left Kharkov. My time is running out, so I'm going to get you a little bit fast to the end. There's no happy ending yet of the story until I get home. But we ended up having to leave. My husband, we went in the morning. We packed. I told each kid that they can take one small bag of their clothes. How do you pack 32 years of your life into three suitcases? So basically, we just took our clothes. I took my ksuva, my candlesticks, and all my menorah and everything I just left in my house, just closed the doors, all our photo albums, all our all our memories, a lot of our things. We left, we had three suitcases, and on the way, before we left, me and my husband quickly went to the shul. My husband went to the Aron Kodesh, he gave a kiss, and he said to Hashem, we will be back. I went downstairs to the people downstairs, the 100 people sleeping on the floor. I went to the cook who has been living in the shul since the first day, 24/7, feeding everybody. She was crying. I told her, we're going to be back. We just have to take the kids out. We'll be back soon. And as we drove out of Kharkov and all the bombs were flying, and we were able to, for the first time, see what had been destroyed. We had basically only been in our house and to the shul. And we saw all the destruction. I started to say Tefillat HaDerech with my kids. And I said, everybody, repeat after mommy. And then when we came to the part, I said, V'tachazireinu l'shalom, and we'll come back. We went for a very long journey. We went for like 30 hours. We went to Moldavia. We were Shabbat in Moldavia. And I'm just going to leave you with the song that my husband was singing there on Friday night with all the other families, 10 families of us, that we all ended up being spread out from all over the world of Shlichim. And my husband started dancing, V'samachta b'chagecha. Now we're coming up to Nisan. We're coming up to Chagim. And they started dancing together, V'samachta b'chagecha, and there was a journalist, I think he was from the Jerusalem Post, and he said, listen, now you guys, he says to me, what chag are you celebrating here? Like, we were together in there, like 150 refugees. I mean, basically, my kids didn't like the word, but we technically were refugees with nothing except for our three suitcases. And he said, what chag are you celebrating? So my husband said, you know, there was a Rebbe that his son wanted to have a candy. And the father didn't want to give it to him. His father didn't want to give it to him. So he started to say the bracha. Shakol niya bidvaro. And because he couldn't say bracha levatala, so his father gave him the candy. So my husband said, we are celebrating v'samachta v'chagecha. We are celebrating a chag. God has to give us one. He's got to give us something to celebrate. So Hashem should give us something to celebrate. You can't be in Galut in Israel, but we are exiled at the moment from our community. Our hearts are now divided into four places, with those who are still in Kharkov, those who are left their homes and are in Ukraine, those who are in Europe, and those who are in Israel. And the day before Purim, I had a Zoom with my ladies group, the ones who were in Kharkov, to explain to them, how can you celebrate Purim in such situations? I told them, the Megillat Esther, you know, you can't hear it on Zoom. Mishloach manot you can give to your neighbor, put some tzedakah in for the matanot levanim, try to have some kind of a meal in your home. And 2 hours later, I get a picture from one of the women that she had made, Oznei Haman, and she writes to me, dear Miriam, I'm sending you my hamantashen with hope. Last year, we made hamantashen together with music in the background. This year, I made it with artillery fire in the background. But we will continue to believe and we will wait for victory. So we should have a Nissan, should be a Geula, and we should only have all the very, very blessings. Thank you very much.